listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. Today I have with me Arkanox. Welcome back.
Hey, how's it going, man? Good to see you again.
It's been, I mean, you came on once before, but that was probably what, like 2 years ago? That was pretty early days, I feel like.
I think it's been twice now, hasn't it? I'm pretty sure it's been twice.
Twice?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember the second time.
Maybe I'm wrong. I know we did like a follow-up. Yeah, I'd have to go back and look, but it has been a while.
I was having deja vu. So today we're going to talk about Greg Egan's book, Diaspora, which I have already mentioned about a million times on this podcast. But Arkanox has actually read it, and so we're going to compare notes. But I had a deja vu that I had already had this conversation or something. So maybe I dreamed it, or maybe that's the last thing that we talked about. Who knows?
No, I don't think, I mean, were you at the book club thing? I don't think you were. We did like a diaspora book club for chapter one.
Oh, nice. That's the reason I started reading Diaspora.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think I missed the book club and then I finished the whole book.
And well, we never did another book club, but we just did the one, which is kind of too bad, but you know, it's hard to get everybody together. And it took me a while to read it, to be honest. I had several months kind of scattered in between chapters, but I finally finished last month. So
this is the official Diaspora book club, I guess.
This is the wrap up. You had the first one and then now this is the end. So I hope everybody were at the first one listens to this.
Yeah. I felt like chapter one, was no more than a warm up. Like Egan is super hard to read. I haven't read any of his other stuff, but I want to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, it's kind of, I don't know how to describe it, but he uses a lot of vocabulary, neologisms, a lot of like advanced mathematical concepts. And so you kind of have to, for me, it was helpful to just plow right through it. Cause once I sort of adopted that frame of mind of like pushing through this like abstract architecture of his mind, then I could really get something out of it. But, dipping in every so often, that sounds way harder to me.
Yeah, it was okay. There were just parts of it that I had to reread like six times, like in the first chapter when they're talking about the higher dimensions and he's like creating shapes and stuff. I had to read that like so many times to understand what was going on. But it was really cool. And I appreciated that he was talking about higher dimensions, because at the time I was actually already thinking about that when I was working on some cyberspace concepts. And so it was kind of just like a nice addition to where my mental frame was at the time.
Yeah. And that theme of course comes back a bunch of times. I guess to summarize really quick, like Diaspora is a book about people who have virtualized their minds and inhabit different cities, different virtual cities. And then they go ahead and clone themselves. They clone the entire city or whoever wants to go, and they stick the city on a USB stick that's plugged into a spaceship, and they physically travel in their simulated minds across the universe trying to find habitable planets, kind of your typical space exploration sort of thing. But the strange thing about it is that all of these people are entirely virtual. They're not corporeal. And yet they're dependent on the physical world for their continued existence. And by the end of the book, it kind of like spirals out of control. It goes beyond just space exploration, but they also, you know, travel to the end of the universe in terms of time, as well as hop from universe to universe and explore higher dimensional life and a whole bunch of stuff like that. And I don't know.
It's wild.
It is wild. I don't know what it just occurred to me. I don't really know what the plot or the point of the book is. Like, there's a lot of really interesting questions that it raises. It doesn't seem like he has that much of a conclusion, which I appreciate. I like when authors kind of keep themselves out of it. But do you think that's a fair summary?
I once heard it said that, I agree with that. I once heard it said that if your book or your story should ask more questions than the answers it gives. Like, it should be asking good questions. That's a good story. And I think that he did a really good job with that. And I think that, you know, a lot of good sci-fi, it presents you with an interesting concept and kind of asks, you know, what if this was the future? What does that really mean? And there's so many implications. Good gravy with Diaspora. There's like, there's a ton of implications for like human society and morality and, you know, oh man. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack. But it does kind of get to a point. I mean, I appreciated that at least there was an echo from the very first chapter of that higher dimensional thought. And I guess, spoiler alert, like, they end up in literally higher dimensions by the end of the book. Like, they transmit themselves as information into a new universe through this like crazy subatomic wormhole thing they figure out from another alien race that leaves a breadcrumb of how to do it behind. And so they like can traverse all these universes and so, yeah, they end up in actually like literally exploring higher dimensions. And then at the end of the book, the main character is just like mapping out all of that for the Truth Mines, which is their, it's like the digital people. They have this sort of corpus of every fact or axiom that humans have ever uncovered and how they're all related from the very beginning and then outward into higher concepts and stuff. So you think about math and you have like the basic axioms, which I don't know, but I've heard of them before and then forgot them. But then you build on that and you build into higher theorems and higher principles from those base principles. And so that's what the Truth Mines are, but they're actually visualized in like a mineshaft, Minecraft sort of way. Like, you walk through these mines where they have the axioms and you can learn about each one as you go through them. And then you get out to the edge where it's undiscovered and unexplored. And that's where like these digital people are doing research to try to extend the Truth Mines beyond where they're at. And that's sort of like, these people live forever because they're digital. So that's kind of like their eternal work is to, well, some of them choose to expand the Truth Mines. There's others, I appreciated this. There's others who are like artists and they occupy themselves like creating art and trying to be, you know, it's much, much less logical and much more human, for a digital person to create art and spend their time doing that, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, the Truth Mines was an interesting idea. Like, the idea of knowledge as a directed acyclic graph seems oversimplified to me. Like, that's how kind of like formal logic works. But the acquisition of knowledge is frequently cyclical and parallel. Insights are unlocked because of intuition or even accident, you know, like a lot of things are discovered completely accidentally. They're not based on axioms. And so there are pieces of knowledge that exist that are not related linearly to anything that came before. It's not a nitpick necessarily with Egan's structure, but it is interesting to think about how knowledge actually develops versus what our fiction for how it's organized actually it is or might be. So the Dewey Decimal System in a digital mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, he never went into detail about what was in the Truth Mines. And I think there could be a lot of debate if you were to try to actually figure that out, what would actually end up in there and what would just be more like in a library. You know, because a lot of human knowledge is sort of stuff we create, like protocols we create, languages we create, stories we create, images we create. And those things aren't like, you know, mathematical axioms, and they're not related to those. So, I think they also did mention at one point, they mentioned the library, because they talk about videos of like animals and how those videos are fed into the growing digital mind to like help them understand motion and objects. The whole way that Egan details like how they form a digital mind was really, really cool. I could tell that he'd put a lot of thought into that. And it was really good because it actually sounded a little bit plausible. Although he left out, you know, obviously the abstract details, which that's of course what you have to do when you're writing fiction, are the specific details of how that all works. But it was, you know, what I had a lot of trouble with, and then by the end of the book, I actually got over it. But what I initially had a lot of trouble with is I was like, okay, you have a digital mind and it's like conscious, so to speak. So they claim. But fundamentally, it's data and code, and it's executing at a clock rate defined by a physical machine. And that's like what all of these digital people are subject to is this, they're living inside a computer. It's a simulation. If the clock were to just stop, if the CPU stops, those people are like frozen in time. They're not necessarily dead, because if the clock were to turn back on, then they would just continue existing and they wouldn't even really know. I mean, they would because of their sensors, but they wouldn't know that, they wouldn't feel that time had passed because they're just going to the next step of the simulation. But in reality, like the CPU had stopped working. And I had trouble with that because I was like, how can that really be any, you know, considered conscious life when it's completely dependent on the CPU clock? But I changed my mind by the end of the book because I realized that even though like all of these digital people interacting in this digital space, which is completely invisible to the physical world, those digital people had a very profound effect on the real physical world around them. And it was because of the choices they made. So even though those choices were being simulated inside of a CPU, you know, it actually had an effect on the real world. And that's when I changed my mind and I'm like, actually, these digital people are real in some weird way. And they sort of explored that concept in those other chapters, like when they talk about Wang's carpets and how it's like they find this organism on another planet where it's like these, they look like undersea carpets. And they realize that the shape of the carpet is this infinitely repeating pattern that is Turing complete. And so as the carpets grow, it's actually computing a simulation of digital creatures inside of the physical structure of the carpet. And so they like read the carpet as a digital form and they can see the creatures that are being simulated, but inside of a computer. That was like, that's when I was like, okay, Greg, you got me on that one. I was not expecting.
Yeah, that was my big takeaway as well, was the investigation to what consciousness is and what the limits of simulation are. And yeah, like the Wang's carpet thing, that is the thing that sticks out in my mind. And I'm going to go ahead and read like a section from Diaspora.
Yeah.
Just because that was so pivotal for me. He says, life embedded in the accidental computations of Wang's carpets with no possibility of ever relating to the world outside. This was an affront to Carter Zimmerman's whole philosophy. That's the colony that the people live in. If nature had evolved organisms as divorced from reality as the inhabitants of the most inward-looking polis, where was the privileged status of the physical universe, the clear distinction between reality and illusion? And so, you know, Egan basically describes consciousness as a type of simulation that is identified as consciousness because by virtue of some quantification of what that simulation's characteristics are. And I don't know, I don't remember if he actually gives a definition for consciousness in the book, but this is kind of your very common emergent complexity definition of consciousness that we have in like in our popular culture and physics areas of study. But there are other ideas for what consciousness actually is comprised of. One that I ran across recently is by Federico Fagine, who invented the first microprocessor. So like, he's a smart guy, he knows what he's doing, and he says that he had this vision one time of the cosmic consciousness. And, you know, his definition of consciousness is not bottom up, where you have a bunch of sort of, you know, mechanistic physical interactions of particles that then come together to form this more complex whole that's more than the sum of its parts. Like consciousness is not mere complexity. Consciousness is the manifestation of a transcendent world. And while I don't exactly know what Fagine is, if there's a label for his idea, he might be something along the lines of a pantheist. But, you know, as a Christian, like, I obviously believe in transcendence, and that creation is completely derivative, and it's contingent on that transcendent reality that exists in. And its purpose is to be subsumed back into that transcendent reality in one way or another. You know, we call it colloquially heaven. But like, consciousness is something that is in touch with true reality. And so consciousness can't be achieved by something that's merely physical. You know, we have the image of God given to us, and it's only through knowing God relationally that we can actually come into contact with him and know what the transcendent virtues of truth, beauty, and goodness actually are. Empiricism and Cartesian logic are, neither of those are sufficient. Like, Kant kind of gets into this a little bit, but still doesn't have a super satisfying answer. Looking at Egan, he presents this dilemma of, we can simulate anything. Like, let's just say we can simulate anything. That means that if consciousness is the result of its component parts and emergent complexity, we can simulate consciousness. But that consciousness disappears the moment it's disembodied, and so it's dependent for its existence in a mechanical way on the physical world. And I think, you know, applying this to like a lot of the ideas that the transhumanists present about uploading our brains into a computer, that's the vision that they have of consciousness, is that our brains are mechanical and they can be simulated by a computer and nothing is lost. But when we do that, we're breaking the link, not between the simulation and reality, because we've moved the simulation that constitutes consciousness to another substrate, but we're breaking the link between our own personal bodies and our consciousness. And if consciousness is an interposition of the transcendent world into the material world, then that actually breaks the link. We preserve only the phenomena of consciousness, but not its reality. And so when we upload our brains into the computer, we then become disconnected from ourselves. We become absent from ourselves. And so this is just like an idea that's been rattling around in my head since I read Diaspora, which I really appreciate. But I'd be interested in your take on that.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, looking at Diaspora from that Christian and, you know, theological perspective, you know, I think that there is a mystery sort of at the apex of that high complexity, because it like you said, you could simulate someone's brain, but it's not really them. And you know, you might have this thing on a USB drive that's like a copy of a person, but it's not really that person. And you know, there's this, Diaspora sort of goes into like the weirdness of when the people copy themselves, and like kind of like the weird problems that causes. And they didn't get like super morally bogged down in it, but they sort of were uncomfortable with the idea that, you know, now there's another me and they'll experience different things. And then eventually we're going to diverge enough where we can't come back together again. And, you know, they have all my friends that I have, like we have the same friends. So what do our friends think about that version versus the version that's me, and like all this really weird stuff. But they don't spend too much time on it or have too much of a, you know, like emotional breakdown about it. But it is a really interesting question.
There's later on in the book, there's the divergence from self sort of thing. So like the guy, he augments his simulated sensory apparatus into four dimensions, mm-hmm. and then into five and then into 16. And so he has this new sensory apparatus and he's able to see the 16 dimensional simulation around him and experience it. But then he downgrades his sensory apparatus back down to three dimensions, and he feels like he's lost part of himself because he now has these memories that he has to purge from his own mind, because they would drive him insane because he no longer has the ability to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was super interesting. And it's similar, mm-hmm. like you're talking about the clones that are in different colonies where it's like, you know, one person has this deal set up to where the only clone that will survive is the first one that finds AI or what is
alien
it?
Life.
You know, alien life.
Yeah.
What do you call that? What is the acronym I'm thinking of? Anyway, and so she's like, we're gonna delete all copies of me, and there's kind of the question like, well, are you killing yourself? And then, you know, if you gain abilities and then later lose them, are you dying in that, in a sense? Are you partially dying? Is a different version of you dying? And I think that's like, it's potentially germane to our lives, you know, because as we get older, we gain all these capabilities and all this knowledge, but then we reach senescence, which is this second childhood, and we then lose a lot of who we were. So like, is our identity defined by our cognition and our memories and our abilities, or is it defined by our role in a relational context, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if there are multiple versions, copies of us, those have to then be different people because they exist in different contexts. They may mm-hmm. have different children and different effects in their life, a different legacy. And so like the identity of a person is not individual. It is necessarily communal because mm-hmm. we cannot isolate ourselves from the world that we're in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, those are some really big questions that the book kind of tugged at in a really, really innovative way. And, you know, those are a lot of that stuff. It's like, I don't know. It's like, I don't even know what the answer is.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there is much of an answer. It's not, like you're saying, like, a good book asks more questions than it answers. So mm-hmm. I think, yeah, Egan did a fantastic job of that. But
one thing that I really didn't like was it made sense poetically, but I didn't like it. And I didn't think it was realistic even in the context of the story was how one of the two characters at the end, he like quote unquote kills himself by like just ending his process and he has no copies, you know? And he does it because they've like reached the end of possibility. Like they know that no matter how many universes they go through, they basically know all of the parameters. They know all the different dimensional layouts. They know what's going to be there. And they caught up to the, what were they called? Not the Forerunners, but the other.
I can't remember. It's been too long.
I don't have the book in front of me, but they caught up to that other alien civilization and they found that they basically just shut down. They reached this dimension and they just like stopped processing. They basically stopped their CPU because they just decided like, hey, we've discovered everything. So we're just done existing. And I thought that was kind of ridiculous because like there's so many things that even happen in the book that, you know, they could still quote unquote live for. Like, you know, there's so many discoveries that like they hadn't, I mean, it's not as far as I'm aware, they hadn't built any Dyson spheres yet. So, you know, there's always that to keep you going. I just thought it was kind of like, I don't know. You know what I mean? That the character just killed himself at the end. I thought it was like, come on, man. Like there's more stuff you can do. Just because you discovered all the dimensions, that doesn't mean there's more stuff you can't do. I don't know.
I like that. Not like you're right. It's very unsatisfying and there's plenty of other things they could do, but like, I think it is a commentary on finitude, on contingent reality, you know, like,
and that's why
even
it works
if they go
in the story,
all those other things.
Yeah. That's why it worked as a poetic thing. I didn't like it.
Yeah. If there is no transcendent reality to enter into and like higher dimensions is not transcendent.
Mm-hmm. Well, they kind of prove
like,
that.
In a sense, it is.
Like they could understand them in a spatial way, and once they got used to like five dimensional space, they're like, "Well, this is just another weird, you know, side of the universe that we now understand, and it's not even a big deal anymore." And we're like, we've cataloged the life that occurs in five dimensions and the topology of stars in five dimensions, and it's like, now we know. Now I figured it out.
Yeah, it's transcended along like a single axis, but it doesn't operate along a completely different set of rules. And that's the conundrum about heaven, you know, like the angels just say, holy, holy, holy forever, all the time. And we look at that and we're like, well, life is so interesting. And that just sounds so boring. But entering into the person of God, the one who's the transcendent origin of all the good things that we experience in the physical world in a really flattened out, contingent, limited way, is it's completely unimaginable because we don't have the sensory apparatus. But like the sensory apparatus that we lack is not a physical one or a dimensional one. It's a spiritual one. It's an ontological distinction. And changing our ontology is really the only way that we can enter into the mind of God, right? Like when Jesus saves us, he changes us into his children, right? We were strangers, but now we've been reconciled. And, you know, that's why all the language about the bride of Christ, you know, when we become a Christian, we enter into the bride of Christ and we're joined with Jesus and we're made one with him. And so, like, you know, one of my pastors, he was teaching about this stuff in theology class in college. And I asked, like, so, are you saying that we are going to be like a fourth person of the Trinity? And he's like, yeah, that's not too far off. That's pretty close, which is a, insane thing to say. And I still feel like sort of like, is that still heresy? But yeah, I mean, that's the language.
I mean, it's a very like intimate
1 John 3.
It hints at a very, very intimate, and sacred position, which is reserved for us, in that union with God. And it's something that it's really hard to imagine, but apparently God's got it all figured out. So we don't have to worry about it. And that's a wonderful thing. I feel like this sort of ties to an experience that I had recently that I kind of wanted to share because, you know, we're talking more about the spiritual stuff. I think that Diaspora is a super interesting book. It is sort of a masterclass in like the emptiness of treating reality as your final frontier. You know what I mean? They literally in the book, they explore like every dimension, basically, not all of them, but basically enough of them that they're like, yeah, there's nothing new here. And then they're just done. And it's like, man, that's a bummer. So eventually, no matter, you know, you can get as powerful as you want. And then you just get to this point where you're like, well, I'm master of reality, but I'm still a prisoner here and I have nothing else to look forward to. Like, bummer. Yeah. That's the ending of the book, basically.
You know? Well, it's like what C.S. Lewis says, like we are clearly made for some other reality than the one we inhabit because nothing in this reality can satisfy us. You know, whatever it is that our desires fixate on, whether it's like wealth or power or sex or whatever, like none of that can actually satisfy us. And so we, you know, he says we're restless until we find our rest in him. And it would sure be sad if that dissatisfaction with this world was not something that was going to be fulfilled in God.
Yeah.
You know?
No kidding. Well, and also, I mean, everything you just mentioned, there's very obvious spiritual analogs for all of them. You know, the desire for money is basically a desire to live forever because money is sort of like time and you want to extend your life by having more money to do whatever. You know, if you want power, you want more control over things, and if you want sex, you're looking for intimacy, that like calling to a higher intimacy with your creator, and you're finding it in the wrong place. And so there's like these, you know, obvious analogs that, you know, I mean, I say they're obvious, but obviously there's a lot of people who don't who wander through the world blind spiritually to these things, unfortunately. But they're all just basically, all of them are calling back to what we were made for, which is not here. And that's also like an interesting thing. If these people, these digital people, like a lot of them were through the Introdus, which is a truly horrifying process, by the way. the Introdus like turns a real person into a digital person by basically dissolving their body in a very horrific, like gray goo type of situation and digitizing it. Like, those digital people, you know, they're kind of cursed by existing eternally in the physical realm, but never having the ability to to actually attain what they were made for if they were originally human. Now, there are some digital people in the book who are like, you know, offspring of other digital people. And like the main character, he's actually an orphan because sometimes the computer just makes orphans for testing purposes, I guess you could kind of say, which is interesting. But anyway, the other thing I wanted to mention was I'm in this Bible study with a bunch of really good guys, and one of them was talking about the benefits of silent morning prayer. And it just kind of convinced me to just try it. And so for the past couple months, like immediately when I wake up, I get down on my knees and I just spend 10 minutes with God in like silent prayer. And the critical thing that made this like possible for me is my friend told me, yeah, you're going to feel like it just sucks and you're not doing anything productive at all. And you're going to feel like, well, that was a waste of time. And you're just going to not think that any of it is good. You're going to get distracted. And that's okay, because God is still near you in that moment and he's still working on you and transforming you, and it's going to pay off and you're going to feel like that. So just accept it and just do it. And I did all of that. And dude, like, it has been changing my life. And the reason why I want to mention it is because I had this sort of experience, this spiritual experience that kind of just signaled to me that it was working, but also really taught me something special. So I was doing, you know, this morning prayer, and I had this moment where I felt like my best friend in the whole world was like right there. You know what I mean? I felt like Jesus, like, you know, we'd say that he's our best friend, but do we really have that feeling in our heart? Like the feeling that you have when you're with your best friend, like say you just really love being around your dad or your spouse or whatever that person is that just makes you feel good when you're physically near them. Like that was the feeling that I had suddenly in this like desert of horrible morning prayer where I'm just groggy and unable to concentrate. I suddenly had that feeling and I was like, wow, that's really, you know, remarkable that I feel this closeness, this really tangible closeness with God. And then for like a split second, literally just a microsecond, I felt like I could feel how much God loved me. And it was way too much. It was like unbearable. It was impossible to bear the weight of how much God loved me. And it only lasted for like just a split second. And I was like grateful that it was only for a split second because I couldn't handle it. And it literally, I'm not even kidding you, like it knocked the wind out of my lungs. I couldn't breathe for like 5 seconds after it happened. And I was just like blown away. I was in tears. I was like, I cannot believe how much God loves me. And I have a lot of work to do to ontologically expand my heart to be able to receive God's love, because it is so much more than I can bear or understand. And so like, that's kind of been my prayer lately, is like, how do I, you know, God, can you help increase my heart to receive your love in the way that you love me? Because it's just so much. And I think that, you know, when we're farther away from God, our hearts are really, really small, and it's like really, really hard to receive any of his love. And as we get closer to him, he kind of works on us and he opens up our heart. And I don't know really what that means. But all I know is that it's true. And, you know, you kind of end up developing this larger capacity to be loved by God. And so I'm kind of on that journey right now.
That is fantastic. I should give that a try. You know, like I think this is like a general human tendency, but especially a tendency among technical people. But it's certainly true for me that I like to protect myself in abstractions, in knowledge, in objectifications, and the experiential side of everything, whether it's devotions or whether it's relationship with my wife or kids or friends or whatever, is it's very easy to just objectify, to protect my inner self from the vulnerability that comes with real relationship. And like the same is true of my devotions, but that is super cool. And, you know, it makes me think of Ephesians 3, of course. You know, that you may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the width and length and depth and height, to know the love of Christ which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. That is, and it's really cool that it comes through a bunch of like a desert, like yeah. You're describing it as a desert, right? That's where God meets his people in the Bible, mm-hmm. is in the desert. And so you actually have to take on that desertedness and forsake productivity and comfort in order to find him. So yeah, that's really inspiring.
Good. Well, you should try it. It's really easy.
Give it a go.
Once you get in the habit, it's really easy. And you know, 10 minutes isn't that long. Sometimes I do 15 minutes, yeah. 5 minutes at the least, you know? But yeah, man. Like, I think that a lot of times God, he wants us to go to those deserted places and receive no comfort, because he wants to know that we're doing it for him. We're not doing it for mm-hmm. the comfort or the reward or the dopamine or whatever. Like, we're literally, the only possible reason we could be there is because we want to be close to him. And you don't get any validation most of the time. What I can say is that it has been, like, God has been changing me through this process. And he always does through, like, you can't feel it happening. You can't quantify it, but you start to see, like, I'm more patient. I'm more relaxed. I'm less stressed about things. I'm more trusting, you know, I don't get mad as easy. I don't desire chocolate as much. Like, there's like things that I actually used to care about 2 months ago that I literally don't even care about anymore. And I realized they were just vain things that, you know, I was like so obsessed with and interested in and thinking about. And it's like, they just don't matter anymore. And I didn't do that. All I did is I spent 10 minutes in the morning doing nothing in the presence of God, trying to just be there with him. And how can you explain that somehow that simple act can transform my preferences and my proclivities in my mind, and like what I care about and what I don't care about, to such a degree that I don't even know how it happened or can't even account for it or control it? Like, It's like saying that like you did this prayer routine and suddenly you just like don't want your favorite food anymore. And you're like, how the heck did that even happen? That doesn't even, how does that happen? That's not a physical, you know, there's nothing I don't even know about that could make you not like your favorite food in the physical world. To say that it happened in a spiritual sense through a spiritual practice is even weirder than like, oh yeah, I took a shot and now I don't like strawberries anymore, or some, you know, some like mechanical medical scientific reaction that changed how my brain thinks about things and desires things. Like, I am being changed. I bet you if you took an MRI of my brain, you'd see some difference now from 2 months ago. And I can't explain how that's even possible, except the fact that prayer is real and it works.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. And like, you know, it relates to something that I think about all the time, which is like, what is the purpose of our work? You know, and especially what is the purpose of the technology that we build? That's mm-hmm. what this entire podcast is all about. It's like, what is God doing with technology? What does he want out of us? And there's so much stuff in the Bible that's like, yeah, work hard, don't be lazy. But then also, you know, like Psalm 90, I really like Psalm 90 because Moses wrote it. We know that much. And he says in it that the days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they're 80, yet they're only toil and sorrow, right? So I kind of think he wrote it when he was 80. He's like, I've been in the exile for 40 years. I'm about to die. This is not that great. This is the end. And then at the end of it, he says, establish the work of our hands for us. And so God took Moses, who was dead, 80 years old, at the end of his life, and he gave him another 40 years with his own commission. And so it was nothing that Moses, there was no, like, nothing Moses was hoping to accomplish. He'd given it all up. There were no faculties that Moses had that made him the right person for God to choose. He was an old shepherd, and that was pretty much it at that point. And God brought him back and did this huge, huge thing of deliverance of his whole people from Egypt. Like, it's the Exodus is like the pivotal moment of Israelite identity. And, you know, so like the work that we do as technologists or just as people is always, it's hard when you're young and you're like, I have so much I do want to do and I have a lot of ability to do it. But you have to contextualize it in like, A, the dead endedness of that like diaspora talks about, like my work is just going to perish. It's not going to go anywhere. But also you have to be able to give it up to God for him to do with it what he wants to do. And, a picture of that is sacrifice, right? You put your work on the altar. You take not only your work, but the best of your work, right? Like in the sacrificial system, you had to bring an unblemished lamb to sacrifice and you would kill it, bleed it out, burn it up. And that was how you gave it to God. And so in order to give our work to God, we have to kill it. And it's like, we do it a little bit more metaphorically. People say, kill your heroes and stuff like that. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And, so everything that we are and do belongs to him. And, that's hard for me to take as a 35-year-old, software developer, but.
So when you say killing your work, do you kind of mean like not claiming ownership or of it in a sense, like this is what I've done or this is what I'm accomplishing? It's not your own personal little Tower of Babel. You're not making a name for yourself. You're just sort of like doing it because it's the work that you've been given in a more humble fashion. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of different parts to it. Like definitely that is one, not claiming it for your own glory. But I think that's just the beginning, like doing the kind of work that is humble, like doing work that is an imitation of Jesus. You know, he humbled himself. He died as this obscure Jewish guy in a occupied nation, as a criminal. Right. And so he sets the example for us. And the Tower of Babel is ambitious, right? And a lot of the stuff that we want to do, especially as technologists through software, because software scales, is we want to be ambitious. We want to change the world. We want to have a huge effect that's bigger than just me. But, choosing to do things that are smaller scale, I think is like, it's not necessary. You don't have to do small scale stuff, but it's one way to say, like, to acknowledge the way that God made the world, because like scale dependence is a real thing, especially in biology, and economics and sociology and everything. Like expanding a technology to way bigger scale than it was originally intended for, or is ideally situated in, makes the technology actually pernicious and cause all these problems. And so, I think about this in terms of community software, right? Because that's what I'm working on. And Facebook scales community software to billions and billions of people. But in order to do that, it has to reduce the actual communities that it's trying to serve nominally, but actually capture, to something that fits within the box that they've delineated for them. Whereas if you really want to serve a community in the digital sense, you have to build something that actually works for the community. Whether it's, the data collection side of things or privacy or UX, but in order to do that, you have to let go of the ambitious vision of, I'm going to make this thing that's going to have hundreds of millions of users. So that's like one part of it, but being willing for things to fail, I think, as well.
That does take humility.
I think there's lots and lots more aspects to it that I have not really thought through. So,
yeah, for sure. I think just a general, you got to be humble enough to receive whatever mission, God wants to put you on. And yeah, it just looks different for every person. That's all there is to it. I feel like the things that I've done, my transition from when I worked at a marketing agency to where I am now with Fanfares, I can 100% guarantee that that job transition was what God wanted me to do. And I can say that because that was my only part in that transition, was saying, hey God, why don't you just put me where you want me to go? Like that was my will in the entire situation. I wanted to work on Freedom Tech. I prayed about it for like a year and a half. I had to undergo a huge amount of patience, and there were a lot of temptations to like jump ship early and go do this thing that's easy, go find this thing that'll make a lot of money, but I might not like it very much. Like there was a lot of temptations in there to go kind of off the path. And I was just like, I mean, like God has blessed me with a lot of patience, because not many people could stick around as long as I did in a job that they aren't like super happy with. It was good though. I don't want to talk bad about my job, because it really was a really great job. But I mean, just I had been there so long, and they just, things were such that I needed to move on.
I've had the same experience. My previous job, 7 years of very difficult work.
And so I just like the opportunity, the stars aligned, so to speak. I mean, it all just worked out so beautifully. And I think about it and I'm just like, man, I have no idea who else could have done this job. Like the Nostr community is not super big, and I'm not saying that I'm super special, but like there's specific talents that I carry from my earlier career that I don't think a lot of other people necessarily have those same talents, because I managed teams of people, teams of software developers. We built specific types of products that, you know, not the products themselves, but the way we built them and the techniques we used directly translate to what we're doing now with fanfares. So, and like my experience with marketing has a lot to do with, you know, like I was building marketing things on this side. Now at fanfares, I'm trying to tear them down. I know exactly how to do it. It's interesting just how the whole thing worked out. I couldn't have planned it better myself. And so I'm just really humbled and grateful for the opportunity. And I'm trying to do my absolute best to stay humble and keep doing my best work and doing a good job. And, you know, I know that I've been like doing fanfares for over a year now, and I have not shown any of it. And nobody's like, if anybody's following me and they care what I do, they're probably like, when are you going to release something? And that's a fair question. And my answer is, we are so close. We are so, so close to releasing version one. So the plan is to have it out basically any week now. We just got to get it to the point where we're happy with it. So
nice.
So yeah, it's going to be big.
That's pretty awesome.
We're excited. We've built some great tech. I'm really excited about it.
You should do a demo and share it around and stuff. I'd like to see what you guys put together.
For sure.
It is cool how God works. Like I feel the same way, like
good.
About his hand moving me to where I have ended up, and mm-hmm. It still feels like, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this or doing something else or whatever. But I'm also reading this book about this guy who was a missionary to the New Hebrides, which is like a tiny chain of islands way like southeast of the Solomon Islands. So Pacific, just way out there. But one thing in the book that was really cool is his parents had prayed. He was the firstborn child, and they had prayed like this first child of ours, it belongs to God, and God, we would really like him to be a missionary, but whatever you want to do with him, that's what they said. And mm-hmm. they never told him. And then he came home from seminary, and he was like, I think God's calling me to be a missionary, but I'm not really sure. Like, I really want to be a missionary. So I want to make sure it's not me deciding it or anything. I want to make sure it's God doing it. And they're like, well, that's what he asked for like 30 years ago. So, and he's like, okay, good. I got
nice.
It. I think that's right.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, it's pretty interesting book. You know, they're like cannibals and stuff. So I'm reading it to my kids. So it's gotta be a little bit exciting. the intro where he's going to like doing church stuff in Scotland was not interesting to them, but hopefully we'll get there. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, speaking of fanfares, tell me a little bit about what you're doing. You sent me, I don't know if you want to talk about your book, but you sent me some ideas about that. And you've been still working on the cyberspace kind of stuff, earlier you solved proof of work for travel, and now you're looking at solving location using proof of work. Do you want to quickly sketch some of that stuff?
Yeah. So I know that we've talked about fanfares before, and it was originally like a thing that allowed you to buy podcast episodes. As we built the infrastructure, we realized like, hey, this tech allows you to sell any digital content, not just audio episodes. And so when we launch, you will be able to use Fanfares to sell Kind One Notes, audiobooks, and podcasts. And on the heels of that, we're going to be adding a bunch of other content types that you can sell. You'll be able to sell images, videos, long form articles, follower packs. That's going to be a fun one. So basically, all of these types of content, like any type of content, like actually literally any Nostr event you can sell, you'll be able to sell through Fanfares. The only prerequisite is that we have to do a little bit of interface work to basically make it tailored to that event type. But I mean, we're going to be taking requests. If people want to sell XYZ type of content, we can add it to Fanfares and you'll be able to sell it and buy it. And how you buy it, how you buy the content is you literally just zap the content. That's it. And so the payment verification happens through the zaps. There's a really cool referral system, which incentivizes people to share a referral link rather than sharing the content itself, because they can actually make money by other people buying it. So that sort of protects the creator's rights. And yeah, we're starting out with those three content types, but selling Kind One Notes, I think, is going to be a lot of fun. People aren't ready for it. It's like you can imagine you have a joke and the punchline you have to pay like one sat to unlock, you know? And if people like it, if people think it's funny, they're going to share it. And then you're going to make more money on that joke. And you're literally like, as an Anon on Nostr, you can monetize your tweets basically by selling them through Fanfares. And Fanfares takes a 0% cut. So it's 100% direct peer-to-peer.
And this will be interoperable with a NIP and stuff. So other clients can integrate this kind of stuff?
Absolutely. And actually, it's our goal that as many clients integrate this this sort of encryption unlock stuff as possible, so that you could publish on Fanfares, go to Amethyst, zap a piece of content, and it will instantly unlock in Amethyst, and then you can like consume that content, whether it's audio, video, text, or whatever. That's nice. Not going to be happening on launch, but we want to work with all of the other clients to make that happen, so that, you know, I mean, the what we've developed is, it's technically like, it's like the NIP. So other clients, they could also implement it where you wouldn't even need to go to Fanfares to publish the content. You could actually publish encrypted content for sale in any client. But we're sort of like leading the charge on that. And, you know, we're trying to make it so that creators are in control of their content and their sales. And so that when people are buying stuff, there isn't any intermediary for digital content. And Fanfares gets them like 98% of the way to being fully sovereign. They still have to depend on Fanfares for a little bit of stuff, but phase two of Fanfares, we're going to release basically Fanfares as a package, so you could run your own instance, and then you are at 100% sovereign. Like, you are publishing your content through your own, you know, copy of Fanfares, which is doing the validation of the payments, sending the decryption keys, you know, all that stuff. So once people can deploy their own Fanfares for their own content, they will be 100% sovereign in control of the distribution of their content. And I think that's really, really exciting. That changes the whole game, because if you look at how, you know, like Audible or something like that works, they take like 75% of your revenue just for being on Audible. Well, Fanfares takes 0%, and you can host it with your own instance and sell your audiobook like completely in, you know, through Nostr. People can quote repost your audiobook, and other people can zap it and buy it. It's just like a whole different way of doing online content. So I'm super excited to get that out there and have people start playing with it.
So two things. Are you going to have bundles? Because I just released a book and I would like to sell a bundle of like PDF, EPUB, and audiobook all at the same time.
Yeah. So once we get just like general purpose file selling, like files as a content type you can sell, you could just zip those up and sell a zip file that contains all three of those.
Nice. And then what's the business model for Fanfares? If you're taking a 0% cut, are you charging for like infrastructure hosting or something like that?
So when we launch, we're going to have a white list of creators who we've kind of vetted who can publish on fanfares. Once we go to the point where, you know, anyone can create with fanfares and we kind of open it up fully, then we're gonna have to start charging for hosting content. So there'll be a little bit there. I mean, probably like a very, very nominal markup that people won't even really notice. But I really think the main way that we'll monetize fanfares is by selling content on fanfares. Like we have, so our leader, Simon, he's written a book. He goes by Short Fiat on Nostr, but he's written an exceptional book on just like the future of micropayments and how it can kind of, with Nostr and Bitcoin, it can just change the internet into what we were promised. And in my opinion, this is like the most profound book about Bitcoin since the Bitcoin Standard. I haven't seen anything like it. And I think it's going to really blow people's socks off. But I mean, he's going to release that on fanfares. It's going to be like the first thing on fanfares is his book. And all the money that, all the revenue from that book sale is going to help support ongoing development of fanfares and stuff like that. I want to release my book on fanfares once I eventually finish it. I'm running it just a sci-fi novel that I hope to release on fanfares and just other content, you know? But I mean, you know, creating good content, like that's the proof of work. That's the world we want to live in, is where you create good content and you earn money from it. It's not just about attention or eyeballs. It's about creating value.
Yeah, totally. Sounds awesome. And then, so you're writing a book and you also were talking about the proof of work sort of location-based stuff.
Yeah. So the book, I'm about 30,000 words into the book. I don't know how long it's going to end up being, but it's a Christian Catholic sci-fi novel. It's like about a near future where there's a sort of like apocalyptic situation. But really what it is it's like a change in the dynamic in the relationship between the physical world and the spiritual world. It's like a permanent change. And it's sort of like the fallout of how humanity is dealing with this new dynamic. I think it's really exciting and interesting. That's why I'm writing the book, obviously. It explores a lot of interesting concepts. One goal I had with the book is to explore like the consequences of sin, but make this consequences of sin like more immediate and visceral. And so that's one aspect of the book, is that like you have this sort of new paradigm where if people choose the wrong path, it's like immediately obvious what's happening. And I think it makes for some compelling storytelling, at least. So I'm excited to get more out there, but I haven't officially released anything. I haven't even revealed the title yet. So we're still pretty early, but I did send you chapter one. So I'm curious what you think about that when you read it.
Yeah. Yeah. 30,000 words is pretty impressive. Obviously you would have to be interested and enjoy the idea. I gave up on my book after 10,000 words and I just wrote 35,000 for my more technical book, but that's enough, yeah. Man. That's a lot.
Well, I mean, I honestly feel like I'm just getting started, so it could be about a 100,000 word book.
Sweet.
I've been cooking this one for like 4 years now, so it's finally starting to come together. One tip on that is there's this YouTuber called, she goes by Abby Emmons, and she has some great videos, but one of her really important things that stuck with me is just try to write 100 words on your story every day. And most often those 100 words, it'll end up writing like 500 or 1,000, and then boom, you know, you're making significant progress every single day. But it was,
yeah,
it
that's
was
how
really
Terry
helpful.
Pratchett did it.
What was that?
He would just write, that's how Terry Pratchett would do it.
Oh, yeah.
He would write like 400 words a day, and he wrote, you know, I don't know, dozens of books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm trying to do that. I mean, I'm pretty bad at being consistent with it, but it seems like every single time I sit down to write, I at least get about 1,000 words, even if I'm only going for 100. So,
yeah, 1,000 isn't bad if you've got a couple hours to spend.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited to see what people like yourself think about it, since we're obviously, you know, theologically minded and things like that. I feel like you're much more well-read than I, but I just deal with concepts.
That's
more abstract.
That's only an illusion.
Not really. I don't know, man. You talk about a lot of authors and stuff that I have not read ever. So, but you know, I'm trying.
I try.
Yeah.
It's hard to read a lot. You know, like people talk about reading a book a week and
holy smokes,
it's like, I can't do that. No way.
If I was a truck driver, I could do that, but I just,
yeah.
Cause I do audio. I can't really.
Yeah, it's true. I listen to way too many podcasts. So
you got that 40 hours per week, man. Got to get it in.
That's right. Yeah. Got to get the grind in.
Yeah. So, and then on the location thing, so cyberspace, right now with onosendai.tech, you can move through cyberspace using proof of work. And that was sort of like my first innovation, where you have this digital world where you can't go from point A to point B without expending energy in reality. That was like one of the first innovations of cyberspace. But I know that to make cyberspace really compelling, we need to be able to put things in cyberspace that you can only access through cyberspace. And right now, or at least yesterday, the only, like if you put like a 3D model in cyberspace, well, you can pull that 3D model out just from reading the Nostr note, and you can see that 3D model outside of cyberspace. And it's like, there's nothing completely unique to cyberspace. And also the travel, like something can exist at a point and you can travel there with proof of work, but you don't need to go there if you can just pull that object out of the protocol and look at a Nostr note and be like, oh yeah, there's a 3D model here that I didn't need to use proof of work to see. So the goal is to try to make this space, this digital space, consequential, so that you need proof of work to not only traverse it, but also to experience it. And like I said in my recent note from yesterday, I feel like Bitcoin, it took the time dimension of reality and anchored it to a digital space via proof of work. That difficulty adjustment makes it so that there's a block every 10 minutes, and the proof of work allows us to basically hide value in time, which is super interesting. And I just have this intuition, and I can't really explain why, that I think we can do the same thing for space. And cyberspace, as I've imagined it, is a coordinate system that actually encompasses all of the Earth and geosynchronous orbit, as well as another plane of cyberspace that is purely virtual and has no correlation to reality. And so these two sides of cyberspace, they correlate to what we actually experience. Like every single thing you see in physical reality has a coordinate in cyberspace. And that what that means is that software can exist in a physical place in reality. And you can have AIs who can travel through reality. And you can have devices that interact with digital beings or digital things or software through this coordinate system. And so like that was really the big missing piece. We can move through cyberspace, but we can't like find things in cyberspace. You can encrypt something and put it at a location in cyberspace, but how you get that encryption key is classically like you either know it or you don't. What I was trying, the analogy that I had in my note was this, like imagine you leave your house and you walk out your door and you go for a walk and you walk for a mile and you see this tree on the side of the path, and you go up and you examine the tree and you look at this branch and like a little tiny smiley face is carved into the bark of the branch. That smiley face, you couldn't have known it was going to be there. And the only way that you could have known is if someone else had already explored that path and then told you about it. Otherwise, that smiley face carved into that tree is secret, right? But to access that secret, you don't need a password. You need to be in a place. You need to travel. You travel via walking, via proof of work. You need to go to that place. And so I was trying to find basically, how can I represent that mechanism in cyberspace? How can you make it so that traveling will yield a secret once you've traveled the right distance and put in the requisite proof of work to get to that place? So what I've come up with is this idea that I've named autonomous geometric vaults. And basically what it is you have a program that you compile, you do some obfuscation and you compile it down into a WASM blob. WebAssembly blob. And you can find that program in a sector of cyberspace. So a sector is 2 to the 30 Gibsons along each axis. So it's a pretty big place, but there's 2 to the 55 sectors per axis of cyberspace. So it's still small relative to overall cyberspace. But you have this sector, and you can tie that WASM blob to a sector so that when you travel into it, you're like, okay, this WASM blob indicates that there's something hidden somewhere in this sector. And so you go through the sector and you feed your proof of work chain, it's called your action chain. You feed that into the WASM blob and it will spit out either, nope, you didn't find it. Or once you actually get to the right spot, it'll spit out, yep, here's the decryption key. And here is the ID of the encrypted data. So it basically effectively makes it so that you can't get the decryption key for the data until you are in the right location. And that was sort of like the key innovation that I think that I figured out. I still have to build this, so it's kind of theoretical at this point, but I've been working on this problem for over a year, and this is the first time I feel like I have something that actually works, because everything else was like, nothing else could actually relate to your full history of your action chain. And so this is the first time I actually made that all consequential. And that was really, really important, because if the journey doesn't matter, then anyone can just guess and check coordinates until they pick the right coordinate and they'll get the decryption key and they never even had to go on the journey. But with this, we're actually like accumulating the vector of your travel, and we're combining that with some other checks against radiuses and checks against coordinates to make sure that you actually did do the requisite work to go all the way to from where you started to where you found the secret object. And using this, you can like actually have gradations where you have a large radius, and once you pop into that large radius, it'll decrypt like the low res version of a 3D model and display it, you know? And so you could have this kind of like distant low res version. And then you get closer, you hit another radius bubble, and then it will decrypt like the higher res version. And so, you know, you're getting closer still. And then you finally get through the third bubble, and that's when you actually unlock the full like object that you're trying to go see or whatever. And it doesn't have to be a 3D object. It could be like, it could be a story. It could be anything that you can encrypt. It could be, and you know, there's other really interesting things that you could do. Like, you could have an IoT device that only responds to commands from people in that coordinate portion of cyberspace. And so you can restrict like access to physical devices from a physical place, which is, I think, super interesting. So there's just like a lot.
Yeah, that's a,
there's a lot you can do with cyberspace that we have yet to really flesh out or build, but I want to try to build that.
That's a super fun idea. The thing that I like, I feel like the difficult part would be, you know, is decentralization, right? Because like Pokemon Go, you can basically do this. The Pokemon only exist in particular places, and you discover them using the guarded, custodial. The server holds the Pokemon,
yep,
you know, and it's permissioned. So doing this decentralized is the challenge. I feel like obfuscated WASM blobs would not really ensure tamper proof. Like, it makes it just harder to discover stuff, because you can always deobfuscate and run things in a sandbox or something. You need a computational element in order to validate the proof of work chain.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could do it in like a different decentralized mechanism. So like, if you did it interactively where anyone can self-host a server that validates proof of work chains and manifests stuff in.
Oh yeah.
In you cyberspace, could have a DVM. That would be.
You could have a DVM do that all day. I mean, the goal was how to make it non-interactive. And I think that when it comes to the WASM being decompiled, the goal is you want to make it so that it's equal or more effort to decompile it than to just do the valid action chain. That's, in my opinion, that's like the golden standard, if that's possible.
So you could like maybe encrypt the WASM You mentioned you looked into homomorphic encryption too, mm-hmm. right? Like, but you could encrypt the WASM with a very small key. And so that key you could just brute force the key, and that would be the, I mean, it would be different proof of work. It wouldn't be related to your location. Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting.
It's a very difficult super fun problem. Idea, yeah. I mean, I've had like many, many chats with basically every AI that there is about how to solve this problem. And I posted the other day, Gemini just straight up told me like, yeah, this is pretty much at the frontier of cryptography. And it's a very, very difficult problem. And I'm like, yeah, no crap. It was like, and you know, I don't know if it's going to work, but at least it's like plausible. Because every other thing that I've come up with fundamentally just did not capture that proof of journey element that has to be, you have to make the journey requisite for the calculation to succeed. And this is the only way that I've found to do it so far. I've mentioned on Noster, if you're listening to this and you're a cryptographer / mathematician or both, and you might want to talk about how we could accomplish this, I legitimately think it would be like a noteworthy accomplishment to figure out this problem. So get in contact with me.
another possible solution that comes to mind is a blockchain, right? Something that's simple and, you know, has smart contracts that are oriented specifically towards this problem. And then you have that like decentralized consensus sort of mechanism. And obviously because it's just like, I don't know, I guess cyberspace could become a really valuable asset. So maybe you do have to care about real decentralization. But I was thinking, you know, you could have bigger block sizes or like fewer nodes or something like that to solve that. But you know, I'm always looking for shortcuts to avoid doing the hard thing. So
I'm pretty committed to the substrate of cyberspace being Noster, because I think that it just makes sense on so many levels. And it also just makes it really easy to build on. Easy in a sense that there's just very low requirements to get involved and to start interacting with it. I mean, the fact that you can spin up a pub key, an ephemeral pub key, and just start exploring cyberspace is huge. The fact that every single Noster user is also a cyberspace user who just hasn't moved yet in cyberspace is huge. I think those things are what's important when you choose the substrate for your protocol. So that's why I chose Noster.
Yeah. Well, it's a super interesting project for sure.
And it's not dead. I know that after my grant expired and I don't work on cyberspace like every week anymore because I don't have the grant and I'm working full time at Fanfares, but it doesn't mean I don't think about it like every single day. Like cyberspace is not dead because like that, I mean, I think it's super important. There's so many things that can be done with cyberspace that people don't even realize how useful and interesting and like innovative it could be. It might just seem like a fun, like video gamey thing. To me, it's not a video game. It's never been a fun, entertaining idea. Cyberspace is a tool for basically exploring a new extension of reality that humans can use to be productive, to communicate better, to build things, to settle disputes. I think it's way more than a video game. And I'm dead serious about that. So it's something that I really am passionate about and I want to continue to push the boundaries. I am only one person and I don't have time to build it right now. So that limits my capabilities quite a bit, but someday, I mean, there's a lot of people who are interested in it. Hopefully someday I find some more devs who are interested in like, you know, helping push it forward. But we'll get there. It's going to be one of those slow burn type things.
Yeah. And it's nice to have side projects too, to keep you engaged. I miss Noster being a side project sometimes.
Yeah.
It's a full-time job now.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah. Thanks again.
I enjoyed the conversation.
As always. I appreciate it, John.